Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly dedicated design show. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan, standing in today for Josh Fennett. On today's show,
when we think about the tale, we've brought back the rondelle. It's an absolutely iconic piece of Canadian graphic design that was a little bit neglected in previous liveries, so we really wanted to bring that back and really celebrate that.
We talk to two designers about how to redesign an aeroplane. Then
the bathroom is the symbol of modernity, and the designer that worked for the bathroom is representing the part of the civilization of society.
Monocle's Chiara Rumela brings us a report from Frankfurt's Bathroom Design Trade Fair-ish. Plus, our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, tells us about some lesser-known architecture in Dallas and Columbus. All that coming up right here on Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. Travellers in North America and beyond may have noticed a new addition to airport runways recently. Last month, Air Canada unveiled its fleet's redesigned livery to the public at events in Toronto, Montreal and Vancouver. The creative agency behind the rebrand was Monocle's sister company, Wing Creative. Its creative director, Maurice Fraser, and design director, Chatri Naranong, joined me in the studio to tell me a bit more about it. Now, the opportunity to design an object as large and complex as an aeroplane doesn't come up all too frequently in the course of a designer's career. So I began by asking Maurice about the defining characteristics of a plane as a design object.
Ultimately, we're looking at it on a small scale. You have to think of it at a smaller scale at a certain stage. But then you're thinking about how it's going to be seen from a distance, how it's going to be seen when you're up close, and you want to have impact at every step. I think when you break down the elements of the aircraft, there are just so many cool things to get excited about. When you're up close, it really is an experience where you're taking things in at those sort of localized levels. So you have like the tail, which is a big, huge focal point, especially in the evening and the nighttime when you just get the lamps on the tail. There's, of course, the fuselage and the wings, the winglets, the engines. There's the belly, which we got quite carried away with the recent design, which was very exciting. And, of course, the nose, which was just sometimes a very neglected feature of an aircraft, actually, which we got very excited about as well.
So we can go on and talk about the specifics of the design that you came up with in a minute. But Chatri, I wonder if you could tell me, obviously the fleet that Air Canada uses is primarily made up of kind of industry standard planes. Mm-hmm. Are there templates of designs for different components on these planes that you have to work within? How much flexibility is there for room in that regard?
There's quite a lot of flexibility, actually. In certain instances, some aircraft, they're quite specific about areas of the wings, for example, you're not allowed to paint. Or there might be some safety or technical requirements where obviously you just can't interfere with it. But I think for us, that kind of enhanced the design. It just added a little bit more authenticity, a bit more legitimacy to whatever we put on there. So we were quite excited by having all these different constraints that we had to work with. But in terms of the specific fleet, there was not one specific template for each plane. I think even though we are supplied certain files that we can start with, we just really have to spend a lot of time researching not only what Air Canada have done previously, but what currently exists in terms of what Airbus do, what Boeing do, what Bombardier do, and just work around that.
So tell me about the brief that you received from Air Canada, and maybe we can talk about the design you came up with in terms of your response to that brief in particular and what you negotiated.
I mean, really, Air Canada came to us. They'd been investing a large amount in some new aircraft. It's a very exciting time for them in the way they've been expanding across North America and internationally. There was a kind of key moment last year that really inspired them to make some decisions where they're refreshing the service, they're refreshing the interiors, they're refreshing the lounges, and really sort of looking at themselves as the nation's carrier and putting a bit more pressure on themselves. And then, really they want to compete with the best in the world. I mean, you know, the Asian carriers are just so incredible with their service, their range as well. And it's something that I think a lot of airlines aspire to, and to build on that is something that I think they were keen to do. You know, looking at what the other airlines are doing, it really allows you to sort of focus on where the opportunities are as well. And I think Air Canada's really been taking notes, and they're really sort of fulfilling a promise. The new livery is a part of that promise to the country as well as to the customers. So
So Chetra, could you just take me through a few of the key design features of the livery and which ones you were most excited about when you're coming up with them?
I think one of the first things we'd have to probably look at is really the nose and the tail. So when we think about the tail, we've brought back the rondelle, which is something that Air Canada, it's an absolutely iconic piece of Canadian graphic design that was a little bit neglected in previous liveries. So we really wanted to bring that back and really celebrate that. So you'll also see that on the belly, sometimes on the inside of the engines or inside of the winglets, depending on the aircraft as well. Probably most exciting feature for us is perhaps the mask, which you get on the front of the aircraft. So when we talk about the differences between one plane to the next, I think the front of the aircraft really gives it that personality. It's the face of the plane. So we've been inspired by previous liveries of Air Canada, also things like the Canadian Wilderness. So it's something that we really wanted to bring to the livery. And I think just this small sort of detail that we've added to the cockpit windows really enhances that, sort of gives that flavour of Canada and really gives personality to the planes. In terms of the colours, that was something that's obviously a very, very delicate and it's an important piece that we need to get right. Obviously, we're going to have red and white because they're Canadian colours, but we explored past liveries and we felt that it just couldn't be red and white. It had to have something a bit more to it. That's where we started to look at things like the Canadian landscape and how we could use that as inspiration, as an additional colour. And we explored a lot of different deep hues. We kind of danced around it a little bit. And then we just felt that black was just such a confident colour that's so underutilised in aviation. And what better contrast can you have than black and white? So it just made perfect sense that their liveries would be this beautiful black and white with red rondelles. So I think that's something that we considered. And the only bits that appear in red are the rondelles and the Canadian flag. So the maple leaf only appears in red and there's no other red on the planes.
Just an accent at the end.
Just an accent.
Yeah. This is the first time that even though the rondelle is red, it's the first time that they've had a red rondelle on the tail of the plane, which is quite unique and quite special when we think about it, because they've had the rondelle since the 60s. I mean, it's not been on the tail of the plane for the past 25 years, and people don't realise that. You know, it's such a powerful icon, a national icon, and it's been around longer than the Apple logo, and it's really stood the test of time. You know, we've kept that logo, we're championing it and bringing it to the fore.
And the final stage of the plane design is obviously the painting of the aircraft themselves. I'm really interested in this process. Maris, I know you've just returned from viewing, if that's the correct term, another plane painting, monitoring perhaps. So what can you tell me about the life cycle of a plane in terms of the different liveries it goes through from production to adoption by an airline and then repainting? And tell me a little bit about the process of the repainting that you witness as well.
I mean, it's a very carefully planned piece or a military manoeuvre that has to be organised across the whole fleet. So when they do have this moment, they need to clear the space at an MRO, which is a maintenance and repair service.
Kind of like a plane garage.
Yeah, plane garage. And really, that's where they have all the parts and they're taking care of the planes. Ideally, repainting also happens at a similar time as cleaning up other elements of the plane. There's a huge amount of revenue lost when a plane is out of commission. So really to take advantage of when it has to be painted anyway. The plane comes in. I mean, it depends. Maybe they've already bought a plane from another airline or it's buying a new plane and they've got different scenarios for each. Most recently was literally, there was an Embraer 175 that was just outside of Montreal for. They'd stripped the plane with some incredible chemicals. I won't go into too many details on those, but it's very challenging. And then environment to stand in. And then you strip the planes with these chemicals, then they peel it off. It's very physical. It's a lot of manpower. Everything has to be sort of quite hand done. You have the sanding process. They're literally getting close and they're sanding all of the screws because they have to take the paint right the way back to the aluminium because you can't have any excess paint, because over time the more paint you have on the plane, the less money you're making, the more fuel you're burning. So they're very careful about that. I was amazed at the details they go to in how much they have to clean up the paint before repainting it.
And just to clarify, sorry to jump in here, this is all manually done? Like, it's people on cherry pickers with scourers going at it?
This is all people on cherry pickers. Because there's the delicacy involved in dealing with an aircraft, they have to, you know, if you're climbing around the wings or if you're doing anything, you've got to be supported from above, because if any element sort of drops off or gets damaged, it's a huge deal and very expensive to repair. And yeah, you're literally floating around in a series of cherry pickers, and they're painting, spraying with these huge sort of spray guns, and they paint one color at a time. I mean, in our case, it was the white first, and then the black, and then the red. Our palette is particularly stripped back from their previous design, so I think a bit of relief for some of the maintenance crew. There are challenges, but it's quite amazing, because you're in a workshop with engineers and with painters. It's a very different environment, but there's a lot of things that still need a lot of attention when you're on site.
Wing Creative's creative director, Maurice Fraser, and design director, Chatri Naranong, there speaking about the agency's rebranding of Air Canada. Every other year, over 2,500 companies in the business of making sinks, taps, showerheads and toilets come together in Frankfurt to showcase their latest developments at ISH, the industry's leading trade fair. The event also attracts many of the big-name designers whose furniture will be the talk of the town at Milan's Salone del Mobile in just a few weeks' time. Monocle's Chiara Romella was in Frankfurt during this year's show. Here's her report on why some designers find the water closet such a fruitful source of inspiration.
From taps to toilets, siphons to showerheads, all facets of bathroom design, including a fair few faucets, are on show at Frankfurt's ISH, the industry's biggest event. The variety on show befuddles those who thought bathroom design rarely strays from the bog standard. The designers walking these halls often work across many disciplines and are equally promiscuous in where they draw inspiration from. The work of Stuttgart-based Phoenix Design, for example, ranges from phones to laptops and even vacuum cleaners. This year, though, their design business manager, Andreas Diefenbach, has created a whole collection of showers, taps and faucets for German brand Axel. It's a streamlined, minimal line called Uno. Diefenbach talks to me about why designing for bathrooms means always keeping interactions with architecture in mind.
Phoenix design products always in a bigger context. So we think that urbanization will be a really big driver for the future, and people will live more and more in big cities. So I think over 70% will live in big cities, and the space will become more and more expensive. And that's why we decided to create a really minimalistical product for this. So this product are not dominating the space. They bring more calm in the architecture, and just to be really, really pure and to get more value for the space.
In a world that's often veering towards the smart home and a lot of technology in every single corner that we can look at, these products strike me as very material, very tactile, you know, very there, very analog. Does that go into the process as well? Do you think of the materiality of things first?
Yeah, this line is really material driven. For this design line, is the bathroom is really an analog space. So just to feel relaxed after a busy day being in an office. So this is create for a really calm space. But we also think that smart bathroom will become more and more important. So it's not about yes or not, but it's about both. But this line is exactly made out of a good material quality and absolutely analog.
Designs in the bathroom, I think, because they are linked to a specific function, sometimes there's only so much you can steer away, because a faucet still needs to function as a faucet and a showerhead needs to function as a showerhead. So how far can you push the form? How far can you push the aesthetics when you have quite a set of rules to work with?
Always two ways. You have to integrate the products into the architectural space, so just to be integrated. But on the other side, you can also dominate the space with a really iconic product. And especially for Uno, it was both. On the one side, it's a part of a space, so it's not really loud. It's not that loud. But on the other side, it's all about the proportions and the material. And this product is iconic, still be iconic. It's pure, but still be iconic. We tried to design this balance between integration and iconic design.
Designing bathrooms is a big responsibility, and not just because of the long lifespan of the products. Roberto Palomba, half of Milanese duo Serafini Palomba, find bathrooms to be a measure of civility and a space in which to find calm and focus. That's why, despite the many furniture projects his studio is set to release at the Salone del Mobile in just a few weeks, bathrooms remain some of his favourite projects to get stuck into. His collaboration with Swiss brand Laufen is a long-standing one. At this edition, he presented a new line of essential bathroom cabinets and talked to me about just why it is so important to him.
I think that bathroom is the symbol of modernity. In architecture, when the modernistic architecture became really modern, so civilized, they add the bathroom as a standard. So this is really the core of modernity, of being in line with the civilized evolution of society. And a designer that works for the bathroom and an architect that works for the bathroom is representing a part of the civilization of society. In terms of well-being, in terms of hygienic, in terms of living in out of the jungle, out of the cave, To be a designer and work for this trade, it's so much bigger responsibility and such a joy, because when you can do challenged by brands like Laufen, you have really the chance to be part of the well-being of society. And this is a great emotion, I think. Even more than design a new nice sofa.
Absolutely. I think it's very interesting what you say about bathrooms being a symbol of modernity. I agree completely with your interpretation of, you measure the civility of a country by how well their bathrooms run. When you get to the airport, what's the first thing you do? You go to the bathroom. Is it a good bathroom? It's going to give you an idea of what the country is like.
It's clean, it's not. Today you can have a house without the kitchen because you can buy food downstairs, but you can't have a house without a bathroom. Even if it's a small, tiny, nice bathroom, but you can't have a house without... There is no house without a bathroom. You need a bed and a bathroom.
Interestingly, the reflection about modernity, many people take it to push the bathrooms into like a very digital space, so you have a lot of buttons and that's kind of the symbol of modernity. But is that the direction you see it going in? Do you think it needs to be that way, or are there other ways of expressing modernity that don't necessarily need touchpads and LED lighting?
Bathroom is a place where you can find a little bit yourself, so it depends what you mean for yourself. Thanks God today, with the digital revolution, we have it in our pockets with our smartphones. So I don't think we need to integrate too much. We can digitalize some functions, but these parts are okay. We have, for example, with the Riva, we have some very basic function.
Maybe you might want to change your sofa in 2 years, but your bathroom, you're not going to redo it every 2 years. So it's quite a weight of responsibility. You have to design something that lasts, not only material-wise, but that doesn't get too old too quickly. How challenging is that design-wise?
Design bathroom means when you choose a bathroom, it will be installed. And when it's installed, it's not anymore part of design, it became part of architecture. So you're not designing normal tools. You are designing architecture. You're doing more than interior. There's not furnishing a room, adding functions to a place. You're really part of the hardcore of the building. So you can imagine to destroy a building because you are fed up every time you want to change it is impossible. So the same attitude you have to try to have when you design bathroom ceramics or fittings or faucets and so on. It's a big responsibility. But I tell you, it's also such a great opportunity to express yourself in order to think in terms of time, a long-lasting. And this, for example, was the guideline that bring us to design more and more simple shapes in order to build bathrooms and environments. They have to be very pure. I don't want to say minimalistic because it's the old-fashioned word. I talk about proportion, architectural. This is more where you can integrate with normal elements like plastic tools or nice towels or nice decoration, but keeping a hardware so consistently architectural that it will last for the longest time as possible.
Designing for bathrooms presents many challenges of its own, but for designers like Cecile Mans, at the heart of every project is a principle that should guide all design, a focus on function. After all, who would want to put aesthetics ahead of reliable plumbing? For the Danish designer, usefulness and usability are at the cornerstone of each project she takes on, including her brand new Louvre range for German brand Duravit. She talked to me about how, in the bathroom or in the living room, durability is always key.
My first impression, or this image I had in mind, was a really traditional small table in the corner with a bowl and then a decanter. We call this servante. You have it in all cultures, in all times, and a small mirror above. So this setting was kind of the inspiration for the Louvre collection. A bowl with water on a table.
Can I ask you about the name of the project, Louvre? Does it mean specifically something in Danish, or is
it's actually in both Danish and German. I'm not sure about in English, but it's like a maritime term for the windy side in sailing. So it's a very positive word if you're into sailing.
Bathroom rituals vary so much from culture to culture, but there are some things that speak to everybody. Mm. And when you're creating for a brand of such international scale as Duravit, how do you approach that challenge of making something that is accessible for many people who may have very many different habits? Mm.
But you could say the bottom line, it's quite universal what you do. You stand, maybe you use 1 minute, maybe you need 2 hours. Every day you have this, as you say, the rituals. You stand up in front of the mirror, you do your toilet, etc. It's kind of the same. Maybe the scale is different. So designing for a big company like Duravit is, in a way, I just need to think of the functionality and the situation.
Obviously, all design is ultimately about functionality, but with bathrooms, the function is very much at the forefront of what you do. You know, the item that you're designing really needs to serve a purpose, and it interacts with many other different materials and very many other elements, like very corrosive water, for example. How free are you when you're designing for bathrooms? Do you find it a challenge to design within a scheme that you can stray from only to a certain degree?
People tend to think that it's not as creative to work under certain constraints and you have boundaries and technical issues you need to think of. Actually, sometimes it's helpful that you have some boundaries, that you have a frame. This is not possible. Okay, then we need to find a different way to do it. It's actually sometimes a help in the process that, you know, okay, now we need to minimize that. And another thing is the word functionality. You should think it was so obvious talking about design. But I would say, as it is now, design turned into such a word you just label something with. I still call myself a functionalist. It sounds very old school, but still I think it's important. Otherwise, we're not doing art. We're not doing just to sell things. It's not just a selling point. We are doing tools in our everyday life.
So there you have it. Bathrooms are an arena in which to prove one's design ability and a place for design to go back to its core principles. In most homes, their work may be kept behind closed doors, but Ish proves that bathroom designers have every reason to be flush with pride. For Monocle in Frankfurt, I am Chiara Rimella.
Now, in all things to do with America, it's all too easy to focus attention on the coasts, to the neglect of what's going on in between them. Well, recently, Monocle's New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, joined us in the studio to remedy that. He told us about some of the architecture that's caught his eye in two cities that many would consider off the beaten track, Dallas in Texas and Columbus in Indiana. Here's Ed talking to this show's regular host, Josh Fennett.
Ed, things are very busy here in Midori House, but it's lovely to have you back in the throng of things.
It's very good to be here.
You've been on some rather interesting trips recently, some that have made me a little bit jealous when I've seen the pictures come in for the printed pages of the magazine. You liked the idea of going to Dallas, but I'm not sure when you took the assignment that you realised the architectural bounty that you were in store for, did you? Tell us about the trip.
I guess I didn't know what to expect from Dallas. I was kind of intrigued to go, and in a way I expected it, perhaps slightly clichéd, maybe. I expected it to be a bit more, you know, Texan, whatever that means, in the sense I thought I might see a bit more kind of cowboy hats and that sort of Western culture. It is a very cosmopolitan city, pretty functional, although obviously the car dominates, as in many American cities. And there was a lot of interesting architecture and design. You have to slightly dig about to find it. For example, not that far from downtown, there's this fantastic Art Deco, what used to be a petrol station. It's now been turned into a house, and it's actually for sale at the moment. It didn't make the final cut.
Is this what you were actually doing down there? I can see the hat hair from your 10-gallon. You are wearing a pair of chaps, I can reveal to our listeners. And now you're prospecting for property. Unbelievable.
I'll be honest, probably out of my price range, despite, you know, my monocle salary. I just can't quite afford it. And also, the positioning, not so sure about it.
So it's snobbiness rather than thrift that's
well, I think probably a combination, but should we go for snobbiness? Anyway, a beautiful Art Deco building, which you might not expect to find in Dallas. And also, if you hunt around, for example, around the Bishop Arts District, there is a kind of mix of some newer places and a kind of traditional Mexican neighborhood. There's some amazing signs. There's kind of neon dotted around the place. I wouldn't say it's prolific, but if you hunt around, you can find some really great stuff.
And in terms of contemporary architecture, we're fairly well represented, whether it is, as you say, the oil industry or the business interests around the kind of gleaming high-rise glass and steel CBD. I mean, we have buildings by Renzo Piano.
Correct.
We have a bridge by Santiago Calatrava. Mm-hmm. Is there a sense that the city's architecture helps define it as, you know, not being this kind of stuffy, oil-driven town, but as actually being a kind of artsy place? You mentioned the development of the Arts District.
Well, it's not oil-driven, actually. Houston is the big oil hub when it comes to Texas. Dallas has never been an oil hub. Obviously, there are oil companies there, but the economy has never been defined by the oil industry, unlike Houston, which is basically on the Gulf Coast, so it makes sense. So for those reasons, it isn't defined by that. But it is one of the fastest expanding cities in the US. In fact, there are several Texan cities that are expanding rapidly. So one feels a sense of buzziness of the city growing. And there has been investment in what is a rather clean and kind of functional central business district there.
So readers can look forward to discovering the design delights which you came across in Dallas. But maybe we could cast our eyes forward to future architectural allures across the Americas. You've been talking a little bit about Columbus, Indiana, which is a story perhaps we'll pick up for future issues of Monocle magazine. But tell us a little bit about what caught your eye.
Well, it's kind of interesting because Columbus, Indiana isn't a place I think that a lot of people internationally know about. It does, in fact, have one of the highest per capita kind of amounts of mid-century architecture in the whole of the US, which is kind of surprising for a kind of not particularly well-known Midwestern town. And I guess it's slightly come to prominence because film released at this year's Sundance Film Festival that's actually called Columbus. It's kind of a film that tackles this idea of memory and relationships and how, rather interestingly, we often sort of tie a memory to a specific building or physical thing. And so in this film, it uses the quite incredible modernist architecture. There's some fairly wacky churches there as a sort of backdrop to this film. So it caught my attention. There's also an annual kind of fair called Exhibit Columbus, which I'm interested in learning a bit more about, finding out about not just the past in Columbus, but what that place is also doing in the future to kind of keep that amazing design and architecture tradition alive.
Our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker there speaking to Monocle's Josh Fennett. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Alex Funnell. If you have any comments or queries, you can write to me at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next week at the same time. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. And until next time, it's goodbye from me.